This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, we're going to be talking about some destruction with The Rock versus a bunch of rocks in San Andreas. We've got Aloha, Time Lapse, Dark Star, H.R. Giger's World, and The 7-5. I'll also talk about some news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and, of course, the world-famous DVD roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. You can find me also on Twitter, lurking around occasionally, at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's jump right into the news. I'm going to talk a little bit about this in the box office section, but I wanted to highlight this initially. The Tomorrowland did not do terribly well last week, not just domestically, but internationally. And a lot of people have brought up the question, and I even said this last week. I'm like, people, everyone always is bemoaning the fact that it's just sequels and remakes and reboots and sequels to movies that have been done 20 years ago. That's real popular now, bringing back TV shows and movies. And that's like the thing now. So when people are bemoaning the fact that there are no original movies out, an original movie gets released and nobody seems to care. And in fact, they turn on it and they start to devour it. When if you really look at Tomorrowland, I mean, there are people who are like, it was terrible, and they spell it with a U. And I look, I'm not going to tell people what to think and whether their opinion's right or wrong, because we all know that my opinion is the most important one and I'm the one who's right. But everyone's entitled to their own opinion. But do you really have to turn on something like Tomorrow? Is Tomorrowland really that bad of a movie that it warrants people saying, don't go see it, it sucks? It's original, it's different. I saw the same thing with Jupiter Ascending. People do try to do original movies, and they do try to do tentpole original movies that cost a lot of money, but nobody goes to see them. It's an uphill battle. And a lot of people have looked at that, and then, of course, then there are people saying, well, they just didn't market it right. And I hate the concept that if you market a movie right, it will do well. I mean, there's a certain degree of getting the word out there, and you can fail at marketing very easily. And I think that there may have been not as strong of a marketing for a four quadrant market that they maybe could have gone to. Maybe they didn't get the message out and the story out as well for Tomorrowland. But marketing isn't everything. You got to have a decent movie to begin with. And I think Tomorrowland was a pretty good film. And I do think that there are people that are turning their back on original entertainment. And it reminds me, when I used to write textbooks for a living, I used to work at an outsourcing place and we would write textbooks for the bigger companies. Chances are, if you had a chemistry textbook in America in the 90s, I worked on that. And one of the things that we would do is we would write what were called ancillary materials. And there'd be like transparencies and worksheets and tests and pretests and quizzes that were in addition to what's in the actual book. And they would come in these big boxes that were, I don't know, about 18 inches square. And it would just be filled with two dozen booklets that had things that you could tear out and mimeograph or photocopy and give out to the kids. I would spend hours and days working on this stuff. And I remember I was talking with one of the managers there and I said, do people even use this? She's like, no, they don't. They say they want it. She said she used to go in and do focus groups to like schools with the principal and the boards of education and the teachers. And they'd be like, oh yeah, we want more ancillary stuff. We want more stuff that we can use to diversify the classroom so we're not just going on the textbook. And they'd be saying this to her. And then behind the teachers and the principals and the administrators, they could see boxes of this stuff still in shrink wrap from previous editions. They are clearly not using, but they say they wanted it. The bottom line is just because somebody says they want something doesn't mean that they necessarily want it. Just because people are bemoaning the fact there's too many superhero movies out there does not mean that superhero movies still aren't going to be popular. And you can sit there and complain about it all you want, but they are popular. And franchise films work, and they work on an international market as well because the international market is booming right now. You get the entire Chinese market. I mean, Avengers has made over $200 million in China alone. That's a huge market. And honestly, they want stuff that translates. That's why international marketplaces well with action movies, because you don't really need to follow a story in some of these action movies and superhero movies to get what's going on. And it can still be exciting. These things translate to different countries and different languages and different cultures. The reason Hollywood is making all these movies is because people are going and paying money for them. And then when they have a movie like Tomorrowland, people don't go see it. because it's different. That's just a little bit of a venting about this, because you're not going to get these anymore. If you don't go see these movies and you don't champion the at least the original ones, you're not going to get them. And you're going to be left with superhero movies and Michael Bay's Transformers. Speaking of Transformers, Transformers is now going to get its own extended universe. It's getting a prequel movie that takes place on Cybertron. It's supposed to be getting spinoffs and an animated film. This whole shared universe thing that Marvel pioneered in the last 6 years or so, 6-7 years, is great. But I don't know if it translates to every franchise. They want to keep the Fast and Furious franchise going. I think it peaked already. Paul Walker's death helped propel Furious 7 to huge, obscene profits. And because people kind of want to say goodbye to Paul Walker, so now they're going to do more. And I don't know. They're still going to be trying to milk this cow when the cow's best milking days are behind it. Couple other pieces of movie news. Robert Rodriguez is going to be writing and directing the long-in-development Johnny Quest movie. And it's probably going to be terrible. Here's why. Because it's Robert Rodriguez. I love Johnny Quest. I love the old Johnny Quest from the 60s. And I'd watch those all the time. If I ever catch them on TV, I'll stop and I'll watch an episode. They were great little kid adventure movies because they took themselves seriously enough. I mean, it was still a cartoon, and they still had some whimsical stuff with Bandit and Haji and Johnny as them as being kids and a dog. But it took himself serious. It was like serious, bizarre sci-fi threats there. And it was really cool. But Robert Rodriguez, I think, will turn it into either he'll turn it into a Spy Kids movie or a Machete movie. The guy has lost his any sort of focus as a cogent filmmaker. And he just does crazy stuff now. He just does whatever he wants to do because he can. And then finally, Cary Fukunaga is out of the adaptation of It, which is going to be on the big screen. And apparently the project's now in oblivion because he was supposed to be working on that. I know a lot of people are looking forward to it because he did True Detective. I still think It could make a fantastic movie in the right hands. But again, kind of like the Fast and Furious franchise, maybe the best days are behind Stephen King and his movies. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first film I want to talk about is the bigger one. It actually opens later in the year, December 25th on Christmas Day, is Point Break.
I believe that, like me, the people behind these robberies are extreme athletes. Using their skills to disrupt the international financial markets. And they don't care who gets killed in the process.
There's a few billion dollars of gold down there.
You're gonna steal it?
No, we're going to liberate it.
Bodhi, do you have any idea how many people you've killed? How many laws you've broken?
The only law that matters is gravity.
This is, of course, the remake of the 1991 action film starring Patrick Swayze and Keanu Reeves. This movie looks about as generic as they come. I mean, it looks like it's gonna have some cool stunts. It's gonna have some neat action. But I honestly, aside from like Delroy Lindo, I don't recognize anybody in this film. I looked it up, and I guess the one guy who's playing Johnny Utah is from that awful Best of Me Nicholas Sparks movie several months ago. But the movie itself, it just doesn't look like anything special. There was just there was a certain kitsch to the original Point Break, even though that's not a good movie. Don't get me wrong. Don't mistake me talking about this as a great praise of Point Break as a piece of cinema, because the original Point Break is really a terrible film. But it was totally this bridge between the 80s and 90s. And it's a classic in its own right, as crappy as it is. But this thing just looks like it's going to be forgotten. The next one I want to talk about is Pan, opening on October 9th.
Welcome to Neverland!
Are you brave, Peter?
I try to be.
The name's James Hook.
I'm trying to save your life, kid.
Why?
The little one, he wears the Pan.
The Pan is our tribe's bravest warrior.
It was written, when you returned, we would unite against the pirates.
If Blackbeard is going to destroy everything, I'll stand against him.
This is, of course, a Peter Pan adaptation. The Peter Pan Begins. It's him and his start in Neverland and how he got to know John Hook before he became Captain Hook. This looks maybe a little overly done design-wise. The big problem I have with it is it's directed by Joe Wright. And Joe Wright, he doesn't do kids' movies. He does these very heavy costume dramas or overly serious films. So I don't know. We'll see. Jury's out on this one. I'm curious to see it. But it could also just not quite hit the mark. And with that, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Aloha and Dark Star, H.R. Giger's World. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with That Guy's at the Movies. Rolling ahead, let's talk about some movies now. The first one is Aloha. A former military man goes to Hawaii to broker a deal with the Air Force and Hawaiian leaders, only to fall in love with his liaison while trying to reconcile with his old girlfriend.
Aloha. I want to introduce you to your Air Force liaison. She's a fast burner.
A double espresso?
Morning, sir. I'm so jacked for today.
Make that a triple.
The old ex-girlfriend. Pause for the memories.
I don't even remember why we broke up.
Because you're a workaholic who creates work to avoid real work.
Well, I'm still working on that.
You wrecked everything, and I put my life back together in spite of you. I think that you came back here for a reason. Let's just talk about it before I explode.
This is directed by Cameron Crowe, and I'm not going to lie to you at the beginning. I do not like Cameron Crowe. A couple of his movies are decent. I thought Almost Famous was okay, but there's a lot of his movies that I just don't like. I'm personally responsible for tanking the perfect 100% score on Rotten Tomatoes for Say Anything. I take great pride in that because I didn't think that was that good of a movie. And boy, did I get hate mail for that one. I also hated Elizabeth Town. And I mean, Vanilla Sky was okay, but I can't really say that he was terribly responsible for that because it was based on a Spanish movie. But Aloha is, you know, it feels like he's trying to redo Elizabeth Town in this one. It's got a fantastic cast, and that's what's amazing. It's got Bradley Cooper and Rachel McAdams and John Krasinski and Bill Murray and Emma Stone and Alec Baldwin. There's a ton of names in this movie. But man, this movie is terrible. First of all, it's poorly written. It feels very amateurish with some of the one-liners that the characters have. And it's even really bad because at one point in the end of the movie, they make fun of somebody who writes a letter. They make fun of that person's writing style. And I'm like, this script itself is poorly written and cheesy and corny. And it's just not delivered right. And maybe it's just the actors he has. You know, it's like how Kevin Smith, he writes some great zingers. But if it's not delivered by Jason Lee or Ben Affleck, you know, the zingers don't really work. You know, they got to be delivered by the right person. They got to be able to deliver that dialogue. And maybe Bradley Cooper and Rachel McAdams just can't deliver Cameron Crowe's wit, I guess. But the movie also, it just kind of gets nonsensical at times and it turns in on itself. And, you know, poor Emma Stone is so exposed out there because she's trying to act really crazy and excited. And in the first 20 minutes, she's terrible. And then the movie itself, it's like Return of the King with endings. It just keeps going on. I swear to God, the movie's only in about an hour and 15 minutes, but it goes to an hour and 45 because they keep wrapping things up. He has tropes in there. He has bits that I've seen in other movies before. I'm not going to go into the spoilers of that, but I mean, I've seen that little bit done before in another movie or a TV show. It just doesn't click. There's no organic feel to it. Now, what's funny is there's a huge backlash against this movie right now. People are complaining that it whitewashes Hawaii because Hawaii is, of course, it's something like 60% Pacific Islanders live there. A lot of them Native Hawaiians. I get that. I understand that as a criticism. Hollywood's been known to whitewash things before. And yeah, Emma Stone's character, she's like a quarter Hawaiian and then like a quarter Chinese, where she's about as white as a sheet. And she's got the biggest eyes imaginable. I mean, she doesn't look at all Asian whatsoever or Pacific, and not even close, which is both a feat and a disaster of colorblind casting. And then colorblind casting doesn't always work. I mean, I was talking to a friend the other day and he used the point. He said, look, if you remake To Kill a Mockingbird, you can't cast a black guy as Atticus Finch because it ruins the story. I mean, unless you're really trying to turn it on its ear. So she's really out of place. And they should have just made her like 1/16th Hawaiian instead of 1/4 and then the other quarter Chinese. The reality on this thing is all the characters are in the military or associated with the military. And in both Hawaii and Alaska, the military connection is not very heavy in the Hawaiian ethnic population. There's a lot of Hawaiians in Hawaii, but they're not in the American military because the American military moved into Hawaii once they became part of it. And the same thing in Alaska. In Alaska, there's a sizable white population. It's not all Inuit or anything like that. There's a significant white population and black population in like Anchorage. But that's because there's a lot of connections to the military and the people live there or they get discharged and they continue to live in that area. But if your problem with Aloha is that it's a whitewashed story, you didn't see the movie because that's a minor problem. And I also I hate this concept, and this seems to be a thing now, especially the last couple weeks, because, oh, Mad Max Fury Road is good because it's a feminist movie. No, it's a good movie. You shouldn't like it because it's a feminist movie, because if you have to like that because it has strong female characters, you got to like Hot Pursuit and you got to like Tomorrowland. But a lot of people don't because they're all hypocrites on how they value a movie based on political correctness. And you shouldn't dislike Aloha because it doesn't have Pacific Islanders in main roles. There's a couple, but that's not why you shouldn't like the movie. You shouldn't like the movie because it's a terrible movie, because it's just awkwardly, poorly put together and nonsensical at times. Anyways, that's a long roundabout way of saying that Aloha, as much as I love the Aloha spirit and the Hawaiian Islands, Aloha the movie sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about H.R. Giger's world, Dark Star. The life and career of artist H.R. Giger is examined in this down-to-earth documentary.
He portrays accurately certain dark areas. This is coming from someplace else, and Giger is, you know, just the guy that this other world is kind of introducing themselves to us.
This is what I call unthrowly a visionary.
You don't know who H.R. Giger is. He's the guy who designed the alien from the movie Alien. He also designed Syl from Species, far less well-known and very alien-ish. He has a very distinct, dark, creepy, weird biomechanical style. And he made a huge splash in the art world and then made a huge splash in pop culture with Alien back in the late 70s. This movie looks at his life. And what's always funny when you have a movie that profiles, or anything that profiles, somebody who's known for being creepy and weird, there's always somebody who's like, oh no, he's a totally normal person. And you'll get that. You'll get like these weird, creepy, strange authors or directors, and then you kind of see their home life and they live like anybody else. And there's actually a scene in here where I think his mother-in-law or somebody says, oh, he's just a normal guy. But you know what? The entirety of the film shows that he's not. H.R. Giger was really into weird stuff. I mean, just he was into dark stuff. And I guess he was a normal guy because he gets up out of bed and he brushes his teeth and he puts on his pants one leg at a time like everybody else does on this planet. But I mean, he doesn't sit around. He doesn't have like some sort of weird seance when he wakes up. He lives a normal life. But his house is all cluttered. He's this old dude, and he lives in the clutter of his work. And of course, his work's very dark and creepy. But it's a fascinating look at sort of what makes him tick, and his ups and downs, and what he wanted, and how he maybe got restricted and trapped by his own work, and why he doesn't. But there's one scene that my favorite shot in the movie is. They're sort of going through his house, which is a cluttered mess because it's just filled with crap. It's books and papers and paintings and sculptures, and just, it's clutter. They talk about how big the house is, but you get no sense of that. It feels like a New York apartment because it's so cramped. The camera goes into one of his studios and it has a sculpture, and it's all dark and creepy. And then way on the top of the shelf is this Kermit the Frog doll. And I'm like, that's amazing, because to me that says, well, yeah, he has a giant alien, but he also has a Kermit the Frog stuffed animal. And that, to me, is the entirety of H.R. Giger's world. But it's worth seeing. I gotta say, Dark Star, H.R. Giger's world, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
With that, I need to go to a break, and when I come back, it's going to be The Rock versus Rocks in San Andreas and the 7-5. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr rolling into the movie reviews. We are in the middle of the big one, and speaking of the big one, we are going to talk about when the big one hits, and that is San Andreas. And no, it is not. I'm stealing this joke from a friend of mine. I ended up seeing it at the screening, so I have to tip a hat to Luke for his use of this joke. This is not a biopic about St. Andrew, played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Although I have to say, if Dwayne Johnson played St. Andrew in a movie about the apostles, I would watch with utter fascination because, I mean, that just seems bizarre. I'm going to go on the record right now and say that I think somebody should make a movie of the entire apostles, all 12 of them, and cast it with action stars like Dwayne Johnson and Vin Diesel, Jason Statham, Sylvester Stallone. That would be an amazing movie. And then really actually try and get him to act. Vin Diesel and Dwayne Johnson can act, and so can Sylvester Stallone. But throw in Steven Seagal there as, like, Mark. And then, like, I don't know, do something just completely bonkers, like Jackie Chan as Judas. Yeah, I think that would make a fascinating movie. Just, I would love to see somebody make a movie, just purposely cast the worst cast imaginable. Do Hamlet and have Steven Seagal play Hamlet. And you could get, like, Megan Fox to play his mother. And then try to convince him to act. And just watch the train wreck happen. It's not worth putting $35 million into something like that. And that's why I don't run a Hollywood studio, because I'd go bankrupt. Anyways, let's talk about San Andreas. Dwayne The Rock Johnson plays a rescue worker who is trying to save his family during the biggest earthquake to ever hit Southern California in recorded history.
People need to know that the shaking is not over. We'll get hit again. And it's going to be a bigger monster.
The earth will literally crack open.
And you will feel it on the East Coast. I cannot emphasize this enough. You need to get out, and I mean now.
This is a disaster movie. That's really all I have to say. It's a disaster movie. Why do you see a disaster movie? You see a disaster movie to watch cities fall to the ground. That's pretty much it. I mean, back in the 70s, when people watched Earthquake or The Towering Inferno, they were seeing it for the spectacle. They were seeing it for the action. They were seeing it for... and then there's a human element to it, too. And that's really that's where the rubber meets the road on a movie like this. And usually the human element oftentimes is not great. Take, like, the Poseidon Adventure. There's a certain human element that works in that. Yeah, you've got a soggy Shelley Winter swimming in the ocean water. But there's a certain human element there, bolstered by a great cast. But then you look at Poseidon, the remake, what, about like 10 years ago, and it's a terrible movie. Back in the 90s, they had a resurgence of disaster movies with stuff like Volcano, which is not a good movie, but it's kind of fun to watch. And I wouldn't say that Tommy Lee Jones does a great job with the human element of acting, or Anne Heche did, but it worked. This one gets the human element okay. I mean, it's The Rock, and he's going after to try and save his family. He's a helicopter rescue pilot. He's trying to save his ex-wife, played by Carla Gugino. I look at this as kind of a weird sequel to Race to Winch Mountain, because they were both in that. He's also, of course, trying to save his daughter, who's trapped in the city. You see the spectacle. And the action scene, the special effects are really good. It looks cool. I mean, it's terrifying, and it's the ultimate in human disaster that we would be terrified of. But, you know, it's nothing you haven't seen in, you know, Man of Steel, buildings falling and entire populations getting wiped out. It's an incredibly violent movie, but any disaster movie is, and it's a PG-13 kind of action. So, I mean, you really don't see the true horror of earthquakes and tsunamis like you would really see. And in terms of the acting, you know, I mean, the I like Carla Gugino. I like The Rock. I like Alexander Daddario. They work well in their roles, and they're not totally stupid. So it works as a disaster movie. It's nothing. It's not a great film, but it works. I'm so wishy-washy on this movie. It was fine. It also is not too long. Like, remember 2012 when that came out in 2009? That thing was like 2 hours and 40 minutes long. This movie's just over 2 hours. And yeah, after the first wave hits like Los Angeles, you're like, how are they going to top that? I mean, you pretty much level the city. But they managed to wipe out San Francisco. There's plenty of buildings to fall down. And they have the spectacle. It works. I mean, it's a decent film. So I'm going to have to say San Andreas kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the 7-5. This documentary provides an inside look at the corruption in the New York Police Department in the 1980s and 1990s.
It was like the heyday of crack.
It was violent, man.
Homicides, robberies, rapes. It was a war zone.
East New York, Brooklyn, 7-5 precinct, the deadliest precinct in the country. Who did I burn to get put here? It would scare Clint Eastwood.
When I first went to the precinct, I hear about this guy, Mike Dowd.
Mikey's just crazy. Michael Dowd was a crook who ended up wearing a cop's uniform.
He was a criminal.
Once in a generation, corrupt cop.
I consider myself both a cop and a gangster.
For those of you who remember your history and remember watching the newscasts in the early 90s, this is the story of Michael Dowd and the ring of dirty cops that he worked with to help drug dealers get away with it and to line his pockets, and how he abused his power and abused the system and how he manipulated the system to get what he wanted and an ultimate takedown and how that all shook out. It's a fascinating film because this all took place long after Serpico came out. So there's constantly real life stories of corruption in police departments that are constantly bubbling up and being exposed. It's a very compelling documentary. It tells a great story, and the interviews are good, and it stays on point, and it actually leads you through the story. It's a very well-made documentary. These are a little easier to make because there's so many real-life crime stories that are told on cable that there's kind of this template for how to present it, and it fits into that. So, I mean, it does feel a little bit of a TV show-ish with some swearing. So it fits more on a TV level, but It's a compelling movie because you get a full inside look at how this stuff was run back in the 80s and into the early 90s. This is particularly relevant today because obviously with the news that we're hearing, there's a lot of talk of police corruption and abuse of the system. And you see that in, most notably, what was it? Like, I forget what city, but it was the guy who actually got filmed planting, he shot a guy and then planted a gun on the corpse. That's obviously the worst case scenario. And then of course the people questioning the use of force by police and should there be cameras on police officers. It's relevant because I have great sympathy for our boys in blue out there, men and women in blue as well, out there doing their job, because most of the people in the police forces in this country are good, honest people. They're doing their job and they believe what they're doing. The problem is that you do in any walk of life, in any job, you get somebody who abuses the system, and you can't protect those people because they just make your job worse, and they make it your job more dangerous, and they make your job more of a target. And there needs to be certain reality checks that come around, because one of the things they talk about in the 7-5 is that Dowd and his gang was kind of protected because no cop was going to rat out another cop. Even at this level, at the level that they were committing crimes and being complacent with the real criminals, no one wanted to stand up against them. And even Michael Dowd going to prison, testifying, he wouldn't name other names. And I mean, I know there's a reason for that in the culture, because when you're a cop, your only friend is another cop out there, because no one else wants to be your friend when the rubber hits the road. But these people need to be rooted out, and they need to be made examples of, and the corruption needs to be investigated and discovered and corrected. That's the big problem. And I think this is relevant. We can learn a lot today from a movie like this, because this says, hey, there's a lot of cops out there that are great, but there are some bad eggs. And we can't protect those bad eggs. And we got to find a way to make it transparent so that the good people can be doing the job without a problem at all, and that the bad people can't perform the bad acts under cover of anonymity. So while it's a compelling movie, it's also a relevant movie. It's definitely worth seeing. The 7-5, it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
All right, I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Time Lapse, the box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr wrapping things up on Fat Guys at the Movies, but don't go yet because we still got one more movie to talk about. I've got some box office to talk about, and of course, we've got some DVDs and Blu-rays to talk about. So there's still plenty to talk about on the show before we send you on your merry way as we reach the top of the hour. First of all, let's talk about Time Lapse. This is a science fiction movie. It's available on demand and in some limited release right now. And I think it actually came out officially in limited release a couple weeks ago. But that's in very limited run. You can find it on demand. The movie is called Time Lapse. Three young people living together discover an invention in the house next door, a Polaroid camera that takes a photograph 24 hours into the future.
What is this thing?
I think it's a camera.
No way. Mr. B invented a camera that takes pictures of the future.
The camera spits out a photo of us in the future. Then we go about our day making a series of decisions that lead up until that moment.
Think about how much money we could make.
Who is this?
That's my bookie.
What is he doing in the apartment?
There's only one thing worse than a guy who can't make good on bets. That's a guy who never loses bets.
I had the chance to see this as a premiere about 2.5 months ago at the 32nd annual 24-hour science fiction movie marathon in Columbus, Ohio. Always at these things, they always will have they try to do a couple premieres at these events. And sometimes you both blow hot and cold. And some premieres stink. Some premieres are really good and surprising. One of the premieres they had was just okay. It was just kind of a little amateurish. I won't bash the filmmakers by naming it by name. But Time Lapse was the big surprise. And it was a huge hit in the audience. It's, first of all, very well done, but it's very contained because it all takes place in this apartment complex. And they have a couple shots and scenes outside of it, but pretty much it all takes place in a very limited location. And in essence, it's a Twilight Zone movie. I have always been a fan of Twilight Zone stories. I've been a fan of the Twilight Zone, the TV show. And that's what Time Lapse is. It's got some decent actors in it. It's got Danielle Panabaker in it. She's the most recognizable name and face in the film. It's got this interaction between her and her boyfriend. They live together, and there's a friend of theirs that lives together. And their friend is kind of a druggie and a bit of a wild child. And at first, when the movie started, I didn't like his character, but he fit into the overall story pretty well, and I forgave it. Even though I don't like the character that he plays, I eventually saw that it works in the film. And the strongest character is actually played by Danielle Panabaker. She actually has the most, she has to get the biggest set of stones, we'll say. But it's a neat movie because time travel films, anytime you deal with time, it can be very complicated, and you can fall into traps all the time. And some of the, no pun intended, and some of the best known time travel movies, like the Terminator series, is constantly running over its own toes, trying to rewrite its own rules. This one's a standalone movie, and it fits, and it works, and everything comes out, and you're like, okay, this doesn't cheat itself. And that's very tough to do with a time travel movie, even though it's not time travel, it's more or less time seeing. But it's a neat film. I don't want to give too much away because it's worth checking out. It's worth like the $3.99 it costs to rent it on like Google Play or Amazon or iTunes. If you like science fiction, if you like a what-if kind of movie, and even though it deals with something fantastical, like looking into the future by 24 hours, it's believable. I mean, it doesn't explain too much, but it explains just enough to say, okay, I can see where this could work and somebody could stumble on this, but it also is not something that is an invention that would go on forever and that other people would necessarily discover. It's very self-contained, but definitely worth checking out. Fans of science fiction should like it. I'm going to have to say Time Lapse totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. I said last week that Tomorrowland was going to win with $39 million. And, well, it all depends on how you look at it. Because it depends on whether you talk about the 4-day or the 3-day. Because in terms of the 3-day, Tomorrowland got only $33 million, which isn't much. But I was saying it for the 4-day. And if you actually look at the 4-day weekend, Tomorrowland actually, when you take in Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then Monday, which is Memorial Day, it actually made $43 million. And that's a little bit more than what I predicted. It's still not considered a fantastic, it's not a huge hit. And it's not going to make its money back, but that's okay. Disney's got the Avengers. They've got Star Wars coming up, and they got Inside Out coming out later this year. They got plenty on their plate. But Tomorrowland was a bit disappointing, and especially, and the reason it's disappointing, $33 million and then $42 million, $43 million for the 4-day weekend, it's just disappointing for a $190 million budget, which is what it was. Whereas like Hot Pursuit, which costs only $35 million, if you were to make $43 million on the first weekend, it does much better. Poltergeist came in number 4 with $22.5 million for the 3-day, and when you take the 4-day, it actually dropped to number 5, and then it was just at $26 million. It did not do well, and I actually had a colleague, a host, point out that horror movie remakes, the only ones that have ever made over $100 million were The Grudge and The Ring, and those I don't even count as remakes because I mean they are. But they're remakes of a Japanese movie that most people have never seen in America. And when The Ring came out in 2002, very few people in America saw the original Ringu. And the same thing with The Grudge. Very few people in 2004 had seen Ju-on, and that's I think how you say it, The Grudge. So those were essentially original movies to the people in America who paid the money to go see it. But Pitch Perfect 2 came in second. Mad Max Fury Road came in third. Both of those are doing well. Pitch Perfect a little bit ahead on Mad Max by about $20 million. Slow West just made, it was only in like 50 theaters, and it actually did not do well. It only made, it made like $1,500 per theater. That's not much when you take into account the size of what it could be. So it was kind of a underwhelming Memorial Day box office, but like I said, when it comes to a movie that nobody's going to see because they are rejecting original movies and they want everything to be the big superhero movie, that's ultimately what you're going to get. So I just hope that they continue to make movies like this because I enjoyed it and I also enjoyed Jupiter Ascending. More of that next week, of course. This weekend, I'm going to just pick the safe number of $39 million for San Andreas. Some people are predicting a little bit lower, in the low 30s. And that's possible. It's going to, but I'm just going on this based on the softness of Tomorrowland and the fact that it's essentially running unopposed because Aloha, I don't think Aloha is going to do very well at all. I would be surprised if Aloha cracked $10 million this weekend. It is that far under the radar and people care that little about it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish things off with the world-famous DVD roundup. Not a ton of movies to talk about. There's Seventh Son, which, you know, there's The Loft and Seventh Son, and I'm going to tell you, let's do The Stinker first. I don't know which one to put as The Stinker, because they're both pretty bad movies. The Loft, I at least give it credit for, again, trying to do something a little bit different, and it's trying to bring a story that's not necessarily a popular story in America to America, and it failed miserably at it, and I hated all the characters, but it was at least different and unique. Now, there's Seventh Son is equally fascinating because Seventh Son is a massive movie, and it stars like Jeff Bridges and Julianne Moore. I mean, you've got Oscar winners. I mean, literally, when Seventh Son was out in theaters, which was bombing in theaters, Julianne Moore was picking up her Oscar for Still Alice last year. So this is the movie that people were paying their mortgage with. But it's a terrible movie, too. So those kind of are tied for the stinkers. Let's talk about decent stuff. You've got Cut Bank, which surprised the heck out of me. That one, I think I talked about that a couple weeks ago. It's a bit of a murder mystery, very Fargo-esque, and it has some great performances. Even Liam Hemsworth, who's usually just kind of boring, he's okay in the movie, but you got like Billy Bob Thornton in it. It's definitely worth checking out, especially if you, it's not quite Fargo. It's not as weird and as quirky, but it has that same sort of small town creepiness that Fargo has. Hello Ladies is also available. Season one, there's only one season. Spoiler alert. This is Stephen Merchant's show that was on HBO. And it's not a great show. I mean, the story is essentially he's, you know, Stephen Merchant, this big, tall, gangly, weird looking dude from England, is trying to make it with models and hot chicks in LA. And that trope has been done to death. It's, we've seen that so many times. And he's so shallow about it. And they were leaving room for development because there's only like 10 episodes of it, but it never got a second season. They did a movie. That movie is also available in this set. If you like Stephen Merchant, it's worth seeing for Stephen Merchant. I like Stephen Merchant. And then finally, The Food of the Gods and Frogs are both out on Blu-ray thanks to Shout Factory, who has been just amazing and fantastic about releasing cult and weird movies on DVD and Blu-ray, bringing them back with it. This whole Scream Factory collection is great. But yeah, Food of the Gods, the original ones with the rats, and Frogs, Nature Going Berserk, on Blu-ray. Like I said, The Stinkers, The Loft, The Seventh Son, they're tied. And that's about it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Entourage, having an oddly early Wednesday opening, Insidious 3, and Spy. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.